This is Jeff Blankfort with the December 28th end-of-the-year edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. As we come to the close of 2016, the mainstream U.S. media's gullible acceptance of unproven CIA claims about Russian interference in the U.S. elections provides another reason to fear for the future of American democracy. So wrote veteran journalist Joe Loria last week on Consortium News. Of course, that's just one of many legitimate reasons to view with apprehension the arrival of 2017 and the presidency of Donald Trump, who even before winning the Electoral College vote had begun to operate as if he was already running the White House. I'll be looking at a shameless example of that in a moment, but first I want you to know that at 20 minutes past the hour, I hope to be speaking with Joe Loria, who'll be just back in Washington from Iraq, about his most recent article on Consortium News, Russia Hack Story, Another Media Failure. In it, Loria notes how, quote, an uncritical press has already printed stories as if true without any evidence, just on the say-so of the Central Intelligence Agency, an organization long dedicated to deception, disinformation, and meddling in other countries' elections, not to mention arranging coups to overthrow elected governments, end quote. That will be at 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for that. The irony and a fact that as much as anything illustrates these unusual times is that the most prominent doubter of the Russian hacking scenario, for which he was to be the beneficiary, is the president-elect whose expression of admiration for President Vladimir Putin of Russia has upended what used to be a fairly predictable political background. What helps the train explain this phenomenon is what the media won't tell you and all the media except for Takes on the World. It is something that I mentioned on this program some weeks ago, which you will not have heard or read anywhere else. Trump has, I believe, been able to get away with his praise for Putin thus far because the Russian president and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu have developed a close personal relationship. It apparently began when Netanyahu arranged for Israel's UN delegate to be absent on March 27, 2014, when Washington's proposed sanctions on Russia for the annexation of Crimea came to a vote before the General Assembly. Other than a brief mention in the New York Times, Israel's failure to back what it claims to be its ally did not raise a comment in the U.S. media until just a week ago when U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki said the U.S. was, quote, surprised that Israel did not support Washington at the time. Psaki was responding to a question regarding a report in the Israeli media that the U.S. was infuriated with Israel because of its lack of a position on the Russia-Ukraine crisis. She said this was not how the U.S. would characterize its reaction to Israel on the issue. She said, we were surprised that Israel did not join the vast majority of countries that voted to support Ukraine's territorial integrity in the United Nations, end quote. Because of the tight leash that Israel's powerful American supporters maintain over the U.S. media, this exchange was only reported in the Jerusalem Post, not the Washington Post or the New York Times or NPR. That gesture by Israel goes a long way to explain why Netanyahu has enjoyed four state visits to Moscow over the past year and why he has been on far better terms with Putin than he has with President Obama or any other Western head of state. It may also explain why Russia tried to prevent or at least postpone last Friday's historic UN Security Council vote that condemned Israel's illegal settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem as a, quote, flagrant violation under international law, end quote, and an obstacle to peace, during which the U.S. delegate Samantha Powers startled much of the world and enraged Israel by abstaining, allowing the resolution to pass 14-0. Yesterday's edition of the Israeli paper Haaretz broke the story. According to the paper's Barak Ravid, a few hours before the vote, Netanyahu called Putin to press him to oppose it. Just the day before, Israel had acceded to a Russian request and had absented itself from a vote in the UN General Assembly on a resolution regarding the investigation of war crimes in Syria that Russia opposed. It is not entirely clear what happened in the conversation between Netanyahu and Putin, wrote Ravid, but less than an hour before the vote, a real drama took place at UN headquarters in New York. while the Security Council member states were preparing their speeches ahead of the vote and for the public discussion that was to follow, Russia's UN ambassador, Vitaly Churkin, reportedly asked for a closed meeting with the other ambassadors. According to the Haaretz report, citing an unnamed Western diplomat, Churkin shocked the other ambassadors of the Security Council member states by proposing the vote be postponed until after Christmas. There had not been enough discussion on the wording of this resolution, Churkin claimed, and he was surprised at the haste of some of the countries to hold the vote as quickly as possible. This report was confirmed yesterday by Russia's deputy ambassador to Israel, Alexei Dobrynin, speaking on Israel's army radio. In the interview, Dobrynin said that Russia had objected to the timing of the resolution and that Russia's representative in New York was the only one who wanted the vote delayed. Dobrynin said it should be taken into consideration that in a few weeks there would be a new administration in the United States and that Russia was not satisfied with the way the resolution was brought to a vote. He said the problem was not the content, but the timing and the fact that the resolution related only to one out of the many core issues of the conflict. But back at the UN, Churkin's remarks fell on deaf ears. Most of the representatives at the meeting rejected them and demanded to move ahead on the vote. A Western diplomat, presumably the one cited earlier, said that Churkin, realizing he had failed to garner support, backed down, commenting that never in his life had he seen so many people wanting to adopt an orphan so quickly. But all of that came at the end of the Haaretz report and was apparently considered secondary to what rated the headline. That dealt with how Britain had pulled the strings behind the scenes and that Netanyahu had warned New Zealand that by introducing the resolution along with Malaysia, Senegal, and Venezuela, it was declaring war on Israel. The resolution was originally going to be introduced by Egypt's ambassador last Thursday, but under pressure from Netanyahu and a call from President-elect Trump, Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi backed down and asked that the vote be postponed. The British had become active regarding the resolution a few days earlier, according to Haaretz. Israeli diplomats claim the British lawyers and diplomats had been working directly with the Palestinians on the wording of the resolution even before it was distributed by Egypt the first time on Wednesday evening. According to the Israelis, the British did this secretly and without informing Israel. The suspicion in Jerusalem, according to Haaretz, was that the British had been working to make sure the resolution was to President Obama's liking, but without the need for him to intervene directly in formulating it. When Egypt succumbed to pressure, New Zealand and the three other governments, with which Israel has no formal relations, decided to have their ambassadors introduce the resolution the next day, while Netanyahu was still pounding his chest in triumph and Trump was tweeting about his diplomatic prowess. On Friday, having learned that the resolution was going to be voted on despite Egypt's backing off, Netanyahu phoned New Zealand's foreign minister, Murray McCulley, according to Haaretz. A few hours earlier, a senior official in Israel's foreign minister called New Zealand's ambassador to Israel, Jonathan Carr, and warned that if New Zealand's move came to a vote, Israel might close its embassy in Wellington in protest. Kerr reported this to his government, but when the sun rose in New York, Israel understood that nothing had changed. Netanyahu's phone call to the New Zealand Foreign Minister McCulley was reportedly harsh and tense, with Netanyahu issuing sharp threats. "This is a scandalous decision," he said. "I'm asking you not support it, not promote it," Netanyahu told McCulley, according to Western diplomats. "If you continue to promote this resolution from our point of view, it will be the declaration of war. It will rupture the relations and there will be consequences. We'll recall our ambassador to Jerusalem." In New Zealand, they have backbones and McCulley refused to back down. "This resolution conforms to our policy and we will move it forward," he told Netanyahu. McCulley may also have been thinking about the case of passport fraud by Israel in July 2004 that led New Zealand to take diplomatic measures against Israel after two Israelis suspected of being Mossad agents were caught trying to acquire a New Zealand passport using the identity of a man with cerebral palsy. New Zealand Prime Minister Helen Clark declared that her government viewed the acts carried out by the Israelis as, quote, not only utterly unacceptable, but also a breach of New Zealand's sovereignty and international law, end quote. Israel has a history, it is widely known, of not respecting any other country's sovereignty, most notably that of our own. That, of course, can also be said of the United States, except when it comes to Israel, at which point the U.S. Congress, with but literally a handful of exceptions, is ready to accept second place. That is, leading members would express outrage about Washington's abstention and be the only body to do so in the world was expected, given that it is arguably Israel's most important occupied territory and that the U.N. would be its target. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, announced on Saturday he will propose a measure to pull U.S. funding for the United Nations unless the Security Council repeals the resolution it passed condemning the Israeli settlements. "It's that important to me," Graham told CNN. "This is a road we haven't gone down before. If you can't show the American people that international organizations can be more responsible, this is going to be a break, and I'm going to lead that break," end quote. Back to Graham. "I will do everything in my power, working with a new administration and Congress, to leave no doubt about where America stands when it comes to the peace process and where we stand with the only true democracy in the Middle East, Israel," Graham added, noting that American funding accounts for 22% of the UN budget. The move received the backing of Senator Ted Cruz, who tweeted on Saturday night, quote, "No U.S. dollars for UN until reversed," end quote. Paul Ryan soon weighed in, saying the decision to abstain in the UN Security Council was, quote, "absolutely shameful," end quote. "Today's vote is to blow to peace that sets a dangerous precedent for further diplomatic efforts to isolate and demonize Israel. Our unified Republican government," said Ryan, "will work to reverse the damage done by this administration and rebuild our alliance with Israel." Senator John McCain said Obama's, quote, "abstention has made us complicit in this outrageous attack," and added, "the abstention emboldens Israel's enemies," end quote. Well, it wasn't just Republicans, of course. New York's Chuck Schumer, who will replace Harry Reid as the Senate Minority Leader, and it was bragged that his name means defender of Israel, weighed in against it, as did Maryland Senator Ben Cardin, ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Connecticut's Richard Blumenthal, Ohio's Sherrod Brown, Delaware's Chris Coons, and Pennsylvania's Bob Casey. They were joined by House Whip Maryland's Steny Hoyer, Elliot Engel, the ranking member of the House Foreign Relations Committee, and, sad to say, Tammy Duckworth, the disabled Iraq war vet who defeated longtime Israeli loyalist Mark Kirk for his Illinois Senate seat and posted her disappointment over the U.S. abstention on her Facebook page. Judging from the critical responses, I suspect she may now regret it. To her credit, one of our senators, Dianne Feinstein, issued a statement supporting the U.S. actions, noting that, quote, "ending settlement activity in the West Bank and East Jerusalem is an absolute necessity if we're ever to achieve a lasting peace between Israel and the Palestinians. I believe the expansion of settlements has but one goal, to undermine the viability of two-state solution. I've met with displaced Palestinian families," Feinstein said, "who have been kicked off land they've lived on for many generations. I again call on Israel to end their expansion so that a two-state solution remains a possibility," end quote. You did not hear from Feinstein or from anyone else who supported the resolution on NPR, while American-born turncoat, Israel's current ambassador, Ron Dermer, was all over the U.S. media, largely echoing Netanyahu's harsh accusations that the resolution was secretly plotted by Obama, the details which he may reveal to Trump. This is something that could not conceivably take place in any other country without the ambassador being sent packing and barred from ever returning, which should have happened when he plotted Netanyahu's speech to both houses of Congress in 2015 to destroy the Iran deal. But this is the U.S., and its media is arguably as occupied by Israel and its adherents as is Congress. The one moment of sanity in everything I have heard came on Saturday morning's Weekend Edition, when Linda Wertheimer, sitting in for Scott Simon, was speaking with Haaretz correspondent Hemi Shalev from Tel Aviv. "Now," said Wertheimer, "your prime minister accused the Obama administration of failing to protect Israel against a gang-up at the UN by not vetoing the resolution. Netanyahu said Israel looks forward to working with President-elect Trump, and apparently Mr. Netanyahu persuaded Mr. Trump to get into this fight." "Yes," replied Shalev, "I think actually that may have been, you know, the final nail in the coffin, as it were, of this episode, because it's clear to me that Netanyahu's behavior in the past few days, if Obama had been wavering in any way, considering maybe to veto the Security Council resolution rather than abstaining, he was probably incensed by Netanyahu's behavior and especially by his direct appeal to Trump. Israeli ambassador to Washington, Ron Dermer, yesterday even congratulated Trump for intervening. And I think that if any thoughts of vetoing the bill were put away by the prime minister's behavior in the past few days, said Shalev, as well as the Israeli government's behavior for the past few weeks as it dealt with the issue of an outpost called Amona and was planning to actually legalize all the outposts in the West Bank that had previously, in previous years, promised to evacuate. Wertheimer quickly changed the subject. Israel's government announced this morning that it would not move ahead with thousands of new homes in East Jerusalem 2 days after Netanyahu had warned nations against further action, declaring that Israel does not turn the other cheek. Just a few days after the Security Council vote, Jerusalem's municipal government had signaled that it intended to approve 600 housing units in the predominantly Palestinian eastern section of the city today, in what a top official had called a first installment on 5,600 new homes. So there has been a bit of a change. And today in Washington, John Kerry announced a new proposal and said that Israel has to hear the reality. This has been Jeff Blankford wishing you a safe and sane New Year.